your best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin.
All right, Tim Gallagher, basketball historian, Jerry's the Bullseye again. We're going to talk some basketball. Really looking forward to getting your comments, Tim, on the beloved Bulls, and the we're going to also cover the rest of the Eastern Conference. We covered the Central Division in the last episode, so you can go back and check that one. But we're really looking forward to having you on today. Thanks for joining the show. Tim, to start off, let's start out with the topic at hand. The big news, the Bulls trade, Tony Snell, the great Tony Snell, maybe great's a little strong, for Michael Carter-Williams, who I had just bashed in the previous podcast pretty strongly. Love to get your opinion on the trade. What do you think of both players and how it's going to help their respective teams moving forward?
Well, sure, Fred. And that is funny. We had just talked about Michael Carter-Williams when we did our Central Division preview, and little did we know, you know, within a week he'd be in a Bulls uniform. Well, I think you and I exchanged a text after we recorded the last podcast on the Central Division and a deeper dive into the Bulls, and we never even mentioned Tony Snell's name, and we exchanged a text about that, about how insignificant he'd become, where we didn't even mention him as we were talking about the roster and roles of different players. So that's how far under the radar he'd slip for both of us.
Right.
And with the weaknesses that Michael Carter-Williams had, he wasn't too long ago the Rookie of the Year in the NBA. So there's obviously some talent there and some ability. I don't know what happened there where he fell out of favor with Jason Kidd. You'd think a point guard and a non-scoring point guard, which Jason Kidd certainly was, although certainly an elite point guard in the history of the league. But if you fall out of favor with him, who's a coach that I would think you'd want to try to model his game and soak up everything he knows from an unbelievable playing career, that I don't know what went wrong there. You know, I was thinking back to when the Bulls drafted Snell, and I thought at the time it was a pretty creative pick considering, you know, where he was. And you know, I kind of thought through, and I never verified it specifically with Pax, but the fact that another New Mexico Lobo player shortly before Snell, Danny Granger, had played for Steve Alford and kind of under the radar at New Mexico, you know, made it to the NBA and did quite well for a long time. And the fact that Snell was a high school teammate of Kawhi Leonard, so again, obviously Kawhi Leonard's at a different level than most players in the league, but that there was that comparison or similarity. And you know, I would assume they had hoped that he'd develop into at least something like a Kent Bazemore type of a player, who's, you know, emerged as a pretty solid player in the league, you know, and very unheralded coming out of college, out of Old Dominion for Bazemore. So I thought it was an interesting pick at the time, but obviously it just didn't pan out. And the fact that the Bulls were able to get such a intriguing asset. We'll see how Michael Carter-Williams plays out, but for, you know, I wouldn't have been shocked if Snell was just released or cut and they got nothing for him. So to get a former NBA Rookie of the Year and a player that I think still has some potential, and he didn't play long at Syracuse. I believe he sat out his first year due to some academic things and then played 1 year. So he's still pretty young and raw as, you know, basketball development goes. So I'm excited to see what potentially could come of it. And
completely agree with you. Let me just jump in really quick. You know, I'm not a fan of Michael Carter-Williams. I said that in the last podcast. But, you know, I do feel that high-end, you know, I think it's likely he could become a capable backup point guard in the NBA. And at least he's a guy you could foresee being a rotation player off the bench. I think it's safe to say Snell wasn't even a rotation player for me. I think Valentine immediately took his place the day he was drafted. So I didn't even think he had an opportunity. I don't think Snell was even in plans for, you know, top 8 to 10 guys on the team. So, I mean, I think the guy had more than enough chances to prove himself. He occasionally showed flashes. He definitely, you know, would have the ability. I think he had the athletic ability and the skill. but he just couldn't put it together on a consistent enough basis, and he failed over and over and over again, despite many chances due to injury and so overall, God bless you. I hope he has a good career. Seemed like a nice guy, but he failed miserably for the Chicago Bulls.
You're right, and he certainly did have his chances. When you think of all the injuries the Bulls have had, especially to wing players, that the red carpet was rolled out for Tony Snell to step up. And, you know, and that's a big leap for a lot of players in the NBA, to be consistently good. Right? A guy can have a good game here or there, but I know one of my friends it's with the Spurs, Chip England, always says, you people just don't know how hard it is to be a great NBA player, meaning the consistency, right, and staying there.
Sure.
So, you know, anybody can get called up from the D League and have a couple of good games, but just to do it night after night, year after year, is pretty rare. And so, and some players don't ever get the chance. And so, I think we can all look in the rearview mirror and see that Snell had his chances, and that consistency just wasn't there. So, you know, I saw one comparison of Michael Carter Williams, a player that maybe he could hope to be or maybe a poor man's version of, and it was Sean Livingston. And I, you know, obviously Sean Livingston's played in the NBA Finals the last couple of years and made a miraculous comeback from his injuries, but, you know, so maybe that could be a role model or the type of player that we could hope that Michael Carter Williams could become.
Oh, let's hope so. You know, one thing I did notice, though, that I didn't originally see, you know, everybody's focusing on the negatives as usual when it comes to Bulls fans. And everybody's pointing out, well, this team is lacking in shooting, and we've added a guy who's a horrible shooter. But I think you got to look a little deeper. And I remember in the last episode I mentioned this. We're lacking a little bit on perimeter defense. And for what, in my opinion, the more I look into it, it looks like MCW is probably greater than Snell as a perimeter defender. One area he absolutely is better is in creating steals. To put this into perspective, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think Michael Carter-Williams played approximately 100 games. In those 100 games, he had about the same number of steals that Derrick Rose has had in over 400 games. So he's much more likely to steal the ball, create turnovers, and now the Bulls suddenly have three perimeter defenders in Rondo, Wade, Butler, and Michael Carter-Williams, who can create turnovers and get steals.
I agree. I like his length and athleticism in that regard. And I remember a couple seasons ago when the Bulls really struggled playing the Bucks in the playoffs, and Michael Carter-Williams was playing pretty well in that series. And so he's certainly capable of it, but, you know, consistency and finding his role, and maybe that's a transition to just some quick observations I've had about the Bulls in preseason so far from what I've watched. And I've looked pretty closely at their preseason games, and a lot of preseason games aren't very watchable, even for a basketball aficionado like me. You know, I'm finding it hard to stay tuned and watching the action just because of sloppiness or playing second units. And I think that's a whole other topic in terms of shortening up the regular season. I heard something on the Zach Lowe podcast where you talk about fewer preseason games and maybe still playing 82 games, but then spreading out the season a little more where there's fewer back-to-backs and things like that. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I heard that too, and I completely agree with you. Completely. That was on the Jeff Van Gundy, if anybody wants to go listen to that. Jeff Van Gundy was a guest on the Zach Lowe podcast. I believe that was the one, and I agree 100% with that discussion. He said two or three preseason games instead of seven or eight.
Yes, and I think it makes sense for a lot of reasons to do that, because you've seen, you know, a lot of times in back-to-back games how, you know, a team just physically, mentally, combination of those just really isn't ready on that second night. There's exceptions to it, but I think just, again, with all the injuries we've seen in the league as well, things like spreading that out in terms of the 82 games, and that's an easy way to do it, just shortening up the preseason. So, the Bulls' concerns that I've observed is defense, and you just talked about that, and it'll be interesting to see with Michael Carter-Williams in the lineup, because just in general, it seems like teams score too easily against the Bulls, from what I'm observing. You know, and especially when Lopez and Taj are out on the front line, you really don't have much rim protection at all. But when you think of a lineup like the three wing players you mentioned, Wade, Carter Williams, Jimmy, with Lopez and Taj, that's a pretty strong five defensively. And, you know, maybe not the perimeter shooting you'd ideally want, but when a game gets tight late in the game, and you really have to defend and have a number of kind of versatile multi-position players, and Carter Williams, Jimmy, and Wade certainly can guard any of the perimeter positions pretty well, even, you know, with a little asterisk with Wade as he's starting to age a little bit. So I think Carter Williams, I hope he gives them a stronger boost defensively. So the Bulls' defense has been a concern from my observations. The other thing is just overall decision-making, and I mean shot selection, clock management. Got some concerns about that as well. And I'm hoping that part of it is just it's preseason and players maybe aren't quite as locked in as they could be, or there's not first-unit guys out there at, you know, closing out quarters or closing out ends of games. But in particular, you know, Nico, I've seen with some very questionable shots and just decision-making, which, you know, some of his what I call heat check type shots, he takes heat check shots but without earning the right to take them. You know, it's one
completely
thing
agree. Completely
it's
agree.
One thing if he's had two or three in a row, or you know, he's, you know, got some momentum going, but you know, just seeing him, I think it was the end of a quarter, there was maybe 16 seconds left on the shot clock, Bulls had possession, and he pulls up for, you know, a shot two or three steps beyond the top of the key, which, you know, again, it wasn't an end of game, but just closing out the quarter. And then I remember they did get the offensive rebound. Rondo got it, but then threw a really high-risk pass to a corner and went out of bounds. And then the other team came down and scored. And so just those kind of things just eat me up in terms of decision-making and clock management. So I'd like to see an improvement from that with the Bulls as well. I'm going to give them a little benefit of the doubt, thinking that a lot of times these are second-unit guys. You don't have maybe your closeout guys in the game in these preseason games, but that's another thing. And then I really think they miss Denzel Valentine. I know he's only a rookie and has barely played, but I just saw enough of him in the summer league. I saw him in person in the summer league, and just his ability to be a playmaker, make things happen, make something out of nothing, which it seems also kind of late in the shot clock, the Bulls struggle to get something good. And so I think Denzel is one of those players with the ball in his hands can make some things happen, either with shooting, penetration, and passing, just his versatility. So those are a couple areas that I've been a little concerned about.
Completely agree with you on Nico. I'd like to go back to that for a second. I think it might have been the Charlotte game that they lost in overtime. I think he was 0-for-4 from 3. You know, just had a horrible game. It seems like so far this preseason, he's either played really well or really bad. It's like no middle ground. I know he's had at least 3 really solid games, but in the other games, he's just been horrific shooting. I think Nico, early on in the game, I think the Bulls need to work on getting him the ball in the post or getting him some easy baskets. He seems like the kind of guy to me that really needs those early on, and if he gets those, he's going to be fine. If he misses a few, he's not afraid to shoot, but he doesn't shoot with the confidence he needs, and he doesn't hit. I don't know what's your take on that.
Well, there's that word consistency again, which we talked about, and he's definitely been very streaky in his career with the Bulls and shows flashes of greatness and flashes of what the heck are you doing? That, you know, those decision making and just awareness of time and score and clock and just all of that just is concerning at times. So hopefully they'll kind of reel him in and keep him within the lanes, so to speak, and be able to leverage his strength.
Agreed. Let's go into the capsules, if you don't mind, and the remaining teams that we haven't covered so far in the Bullseye. I'll turn it over to you. Are you going to rank them from worst to best?
Well, I'll quickly go through the Atlantic Division and Southeast Division teams, and then what I'll do at the end, I'll integrate those that I think will be in the playoffs with the Central Division. So we'll go through a 1-8. So, but yeah, we can kind of go worst to first. Yeah, we can go worst to first as well by each division. So just give really brief capsules of each team and some significant player movement, coaching changes, things with the teams. So we'll start with the Atlantic Division, and we've got two cellar dwellers, probably the worst two teams in the league, with Philly and Brooklyn. With the Sixers, and some of it's a little bit excusable with the Sixers because they had the Sam Hinkie experiment that kind of went haywire. So kind of the mad scientist in terms of stockpiling draft picks and stashing young players in Europe and tanking, even though they never called it that. But after all that, and Sam Hinkie's gone, they're still bad. And they've got a mix of undeveloped young players and veterans who aren't stars. So and then Ben Simmons breaks his foot and is out indefinitely. So I just think they're going to be a train wreck again. Now, the fact that Brian Colangelo is the GM, his father Jerry Colangelo is in the front office, they'll get it on the right track, but it's going to take time, and it's a very unforgiving league for if you're weak. And so, they might compete and hang in there in some games, but they were 10-72 last year. I see them improving slightly to 14-68 this year. So,
wow,
still pretty bad.
Not good. Yep.
Brooklyn is really not that much farther ahead, and again, they're still paying the price for acquiring Garnett and Paul Pierce and trying to win instantly with, aging veterans and unsure chemistry. And so they've got a first-year coach, Kenny Atkinson, which was probably one of the most quiet coaching moves and changes in the history of the league, I think. Who's he? He's been an assistant in the league for a while, was a former player in the CDA, which was the D League before the D League existed, and probably a capable young coach and been a great player development coach. But I look at their roster, and beyond Brooke Lopez, Jeremy Lin, and Randy Foy, the rest of that roster, if you took away those three guys, I think would have a hard time finishing strong in the D League. So I just think that's a very bad team as well. They were 21-61 last year. I'll give them a little leeway and have them win 22 this year, 22-60, but still a pretty bad team. We'll move up next to the Knicks. One of the things in the league that you see from the really good teams is stability, either as a core of players or with coaching. And the Knicks obviously have not had that. Other than Carmelo, they really haven't had any stability beyond that. And a lot of eyes on them, obviously, with Phil Jackson in charge of everything. And I was a little surprised they hired Jeff Hornacek. Not that Hornacek's not a very capable coach. He did well in Phoenix when he had some talent, although things kind of crashed and burned for him there. But I don't think that was all him. There's an emerging star in Porzingis, so I like what's ahead for him. One of the more intriguing players in the league, and hopefully he can build on his rookie success. But with picking up some fragile veterans like Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah, I almost thought of their roster with something like Bulls injured list East. And again, I see maybe the Knicks improving slightly, but losing players like Robin Lopez, who's a Bull now, Aaron Aflalo, so solid pros that are going to compete every night and be good role models for young players, those guys are gone, and I don't think their roster has really been upgraded. Obviously, with the coaching mess last year, Fisher not doing the job, Derek Fisher. I've got slight improvement. They were 32-50 last year. I've got them at 37-45 this year. So still out of the playoffs, slight improvement, but still a mountain to climb. And you know, certainly well below, but are probably unrealistic expectations anyway of Knicks fans.
Okay.
As we move up a little bit, then we've got the Celtics, second from the top in the Atlantic. I thought they really overachieved last year, and I think a lot of that is due to Brad Stevens' coaching and leadership. And I was frankly a little surprised how well he's progressed as an NBA coach. Not that I doubted his ability. I've watched him very closely at Butler and know what he was able to do there. And just his demeanor and knowledge of the game, I think, is top notch. But when your best player on your team is a 5'9 point guard, and I'm talking about Isaiah Thomas, who's an amazing talent, but, you know, I was thinking back in the history of the league, you know, and when's the last time a team with a sub-6-foot point guard made the NBA Finals or won an NBA title? And I really couldn't think of one, at least in the modern era, right? So post-1960. And Isaiah Thomas, I guess, you know, would be one of the smaller point guards, but he's listed at 6 foot or so. He might be slightly below that. But I just don't think you can win deep in the playoffs when your best player is a 5'9 point guard.
Agreed.
And I'm not saying I don't appreciate Isaiah Thomas and what he's able to do, but I think playoff time, when you're having to switch up defensively, pick and rolls, you know, who's he going to guard? And even though he comes down and does some amazing scoring, I don't see it. They were
Al Horford, though. Now it was probably their best player, right? With that acquisition, what do you think?
Well, I think that is a key addition, and he's certainly a pro's pro, you know, an established all-star in the league. Although, I don't know that I'd put him as an elite-level type superstar. Is he a go-to guy at the end of games? You know, Atlanta kind of has always done it by committee, and we'll talk about Atlanta here in a minute with the Southeast Division. So, while he's a winner, a proven class pro, I just don't see him as an elite superstar. And so I think despite how good he is, I don't know that puts them over the hump or takes their team to another level. So they were 48-34 last year, which I thought was an overachievement. I think they're going to slightly slip this year to 45-37. So, and I think whatever they might be lacking in the roster, I'm giving some, you know, the Brad Stevens factor, some credit to get some additional wins, but still not quite as strong as they were last year. And then at the top of the Atlantic Division, I've got Toronto, which a couple things with Toronto. They were 56-26 last year. I see them right about there again this year, slightly worse. I've got them at 54-28 this year. You know, they have a proven coach in Dwayne Casey. He's been there a while. They've got a system, and a system that works. You know, they did beat the Cavs twice in the Eastern Conference Finals. I don't know how they did it. I thought they were overmatched, but think about it. You know, the NBA champs, they did beat them twice. Granted, they were home games in Toronto, but I think that's a pretty significant accomplishment, which I thought they'd probably get swept in that series by Cleveland. So there's some talent there too. When you look at that core lineup of DeRozan, Kyle Lowry, Valanciunas, let's put Damari Carroll, Corey Joseph, Terrence Ross, Patrick Patterson. Obviously those last couple guys are more role players, but established, proven role players in the league. That's a pretty strong core. They also picked up Jared Sullinger from Boston, who's, you know, a pretty solid contributor who's had playoff experience. Norman Powell, we talked about him during the Final Four of the playoffs last year, is really the only rookie getting rotation minutes of the four teams that made it to the conference finals. So he seems to be emerging. A couple interesting draft picks with Jakob Poeltl out of Utah, the big man as a backup. And then one of my sleepers in the draft is Pascal Siakam out in New Mexico State. And I have watched Toronto a little bit in the preseason, and he's one of the players that has been a pleasant surprise to me. So I've got Toronto winning that division, 54-28, a couple wins fewer than last season, but still enough to pretty comfortably win the Atlantic.
Great. So is there any other ones that we haven't covered that you want to talk about and touch base on that are near the end? Does anybody else that you want to add?
Well, that's the Atlantic Division. I can quickly run through the Southeast Division before we wrap up.
Absolutely. Let's do that.
Okay. And this is a pretty solid division, sort of like the Bulls division, where there's not too much weakness in the league. When I consider Miami is probably going to be toward the cellar of that division, and obviously we'll start with them. They were 48-34 last year, which was, I think, a little bit of an overachievement for them. You know, Wade played great last year. Thank goodness he's on the Bulls now, and hopefully he'll show some carryover of what he produced last year on the floor. But when I look at Miami, I've got it kind of boiled down to no Wade, no Bosch, no playoffs. And when your cornerstones are Hassan Whiteside and Justice Winslow and Goran Dragic, that's not a playoff team in my view. So I've got the Heat tied at the bottom of the Southeast Division. I have them going 38-42. So with Spoelstra's coaching, Pat Riley's leadership in the front office, I can't see them totally tanking or not being competitive every night. So they'll be close to 500, but not a playoff team. Also in the cellar, tied with them in my prediction, is Orlando. I have them at 38-44. That's a couple of wins better than they were last year. They were 35-47. I think the key with them is that they've got a new coach in Frank Vogel, who Bulls fans will know of the solid job he's done over a period of years with the Pacers, a pretty good body of work there. Although it's his first year there and kind of integrating his system, they've got some new players. They picked up Serge Ibaka from OKC. There's a couple of variables there, though, that are unknown. Is Aaron Gordon really going to be able to take it to another level? There's that word consistency again, right? He's shown flashes. He can do incredible dunks, but can he play night in and night out? Can he be a 15-9 guy night after night? I don't know. And I think they have one of the more underrated players in the league. We talked about him as the most improved, as Evan Fournier, who I think is a solid player as well. But kind of a young roster and a new coach, so I think they're going to be on a better trajectory with Vogel, but not this year. So tied with Miami at 38 wins at the bottom
Great.
Of the division. Moving up the list a little bit, and I think these three teams are fairly evenly matched. I've got the Wizards next. They were 41-41, kind of like the Bulls last year. Injuries, they kind of limped to the finish line, literally, and didn't make the playoffs for the first time in a couple seasons. And with that core of Bradley Beal and John Wall, who you could argue maybe are kind of a poor man's Splash Brothers, or certainly a Splash Brothers East. Those two are pretty dynamic players. New coach in Scott Brooks. I thought Randy Whitman did a pretty decent job there as well. So I think that coaching swap is really kind of an even swap. I didn't have an issue with either one of those guys in terms of their ability to coach in the league and prepare. So the Wizards were 41-41 last year. I see them winning a couple more games, 43-39. So kind of right on the, just a little bit better than 500, a little slight improvement over last year. And then the two teams I have tied for the top, I shouldn't say tied. I've got the Hornets next with 45 wins. They were 48-34 last year, another overachieving team, and I think a very underrated coach in Steve Clifford. And they sure always play well against the Bulls, don't you think?
Agree completely, including last night.
Gosh, they bring out the worst in the Bulls, it seems, or the Bulls bring out the best in Charlotte. But, they're a pretty competent team, and, Kemba Walker, Nicholas Batum, pretty solid guys, although, watching Roy Hibbert out there, I had to painfully watch him. We get a lot of all the Laker games, obviously, out west here, and not one of my favorite players in the league to watch, Roy Hibbert. So he's camping in the lane now for Charlotte. I think
right.
Clifford's coaching and some solid players and building on their momentum of last year. I have them slightly worse than last year. They were 48-34 last season. I've got them at 45-37. And then The top of the division are the Atlanta Hawks. So 48-34 last year, and I predict they're going to have the same finish, 48-34, this season. And a couple interesting changes to Atlanta's roster. Now, Horford is gone, but they picked up Dwight Howard, who is certainly as big an X-factor in the league as you could come up with, but maybe the change of scenery, returning to his hometown of Atlanta, hopefully looking for some redemption. And then being on a team with a lineup of kind of no-nonsense pros, guys like Paul Millsap, guys like Kyle Korver, Jarrett Jack is another one of those X-factor players that I've always liked in the league. So not a star, but just a clutch pro that I think will definitely add some maturity and kind of keep the beat going for Atlanta. They've had a nice little run under Coach Budenholzer, and I think it'll be enough to win the Southeast Division again this year. So with that, I can quickly run down my Eastern Conference top eight playoff teams, and we'll integrate, obviously, the Central Division teams into that. So we'll just run them down the list. So, obviously, Cleveland is at the top. Number two is Toronto. Three seed will be the Celtics. Fourth seed is the Hawks. Fifth seed, I have the Bulls. Sixth seed is the Hornets. Wizards would be the seventh seed, and then the Pistons will get that final playoff spot with a 41-41 record. So I know that wouldn't have got people into the playoffs last year, as the Bulls can well testify. 42 wins didn't get them in. But I think this year, some of those teams that I felt like overachieved a little bit last year, I think they'll not have quite as many wins, and those would be my 1-8 for the Eastern Conference.
Thanks, Tim. Great stuff as usual. Really appreciate it. To wrap things up, though, I'd like to get your official prediction. Obviously, you think Cleveland's going to probably represent the team in the East. Who do you foresee in the NFC, Eastern Conference Championship?
That's a great question. I don't think the Celtics will get there. I know a lot of people think the Celtics are ready to make that next step. I think if they have home court, I could see Toronto getting back there again. The other interesting thing, as we will preview the Western Conference as well, in the history of the league, we might have touched on this briefly in another podcast, the same two teams have not met in the finals three consecutive years. So the odds are against the Golden State-Cleveland final, because it's never happened in the history of the league. You'd think with all the years the Celtics played the Lakers, but it never happened in three consecutive seasons. So obviously those are two teams that could break the mold, and we've seen them break the mold in terms of doing things that have never been done before, both Cleveland and Golden State. So it wouldn't be shocking if that happened, but I'm just saying that it's never happened before in the history of the league.
Amazing. I did not know that. That's a great statistic, and it just shows how hard it is to do. And like I said before, one injury to LeBron, Cleveland's not going to be representing the East. It's not going to happen. In fact, I predict they'd probably lose in the second round, maybe first. So they'd still be a playoff team, but they're not good enough to win a title or even get out of the East, in my opinion. Would you say that, too? If you take LeBron off the Cavs, do they come out of the East?
I don't think so. No, I don't. And, we talked about them, obviously, on the last podcast. And, obviously LeBron's a transcendent player. But when you look at the rest of their roster and the additions, the Birdman Anderson, Dunleavy. So these are aging veterans who've had injury problems. And, so those are the guys that are going to take you to the next step. Cleveland, they weren't picking up any Al Horfords or players at that level. So I think the fact that LeBron is such a transcendent talent and player and winner that he makes up for a lot of deficiencies. So certainly if LeBron was hurt, it would be a whole different picture in Cleveland. But, again, he's never been hurt. So I think we can assume that things are going to continue on.
Agreed. Tim, thank you so much for your insight and your addition to the Bullseye. I'm just really looking forward to talking with you very soon as the real games begin to start.
That sounds great, Fred. And go Cubs, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, Tim. Have a good one, brother.